Hello, and welcome to episode number 99 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. In the recent move towards a more mainstream consideration of the enigma, colloquially known as the UFO phenomenon, we are seeing increasing discussion around the alleged technology recovered. We are also seeing robust conversation arising around whether or not this anomalous technology may have made its way into the top-secret craft being developed and operated by the military-industrial complex by way of successful reverse engineering. While such a move is a welcome sign for ufologists and those who are merely enthused about the topic alike, this development leaves out one absolutely fundamental component of the entire matter, that of the nature and intentions of the intelligences responsible for such technology. The fact that this obvious implication is not being discussed in the mainstream perhaps hints at a deep subconscious nervousness around what this may mean for our civilization's own self-understanding. When one adds to the mix the fact that perhaps all along, the reality of these various others, these NHI, as they are now referred to in official circles, has been staring us in the face, in the form of the very religious traditions we've embraced as our meaning-making models of the world, only adds to the strange sense that there's something we as a modern civilization have almost willingly turned our gaze away from. In today's podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the surprisingly compelling notion that the beings, sometimes referred to as gods, and sometimes conflated as a single deity in monotheistic traditions, points almost squarely towards the very non-human intelligences said to be responsible for the mysteriously daunting behavior being increasingly witnessed and recorded in our modern day. What do our most revered spiritual traditions, when read in the correct context, say of these beings and their role in the seeding and subsequent development of humankind? And what might this mean for what's happening even now, and where we are headed as a supposedly sophisticated modern civilization? These are the most consequential matters we'll seek to engage with in this, the 99th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to point out that if you would like to support this podcast, and in so doing gain access to all of my content, which includes not just Point of Convergence and Liminal Frames, but also OTC Squared and the various feature series I create, as well as access to my private Discord server and early access and discounts to my online courses and private retreats, as well as access to my live Q&A sessions, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, with that preamble aside, let's move on to today's episode topic. Today we're going to be talking about the connection between some of our most ancient, revered spiritual traditions and the texts that record encounters with supposed gods or deities and the modern UFO phenomenon. What's interesting is that often in the modern conversation, at least at the public level, we are not really engaging with who these beings are and what they want, what their intentions are. And yet, ironically, at the very same time, billions of people around the world follow certain religious traditions that I would suggest, when read in the correct context, point squarely in the direction of the very same beings that we are only now beginning to reckon with in terms of these non-human intelligences. And it is precisely that notion that led me to post the following to social media this last week. I said, quote, "To blow the lid off the true history of the UAP/NHI issue is to begin to blow the lid off our conventional understanding of all of history. This is not about adding an element to the existing mix, but exposing the illusory nature of our assumed foundations," unquote. This is exactly why the disclosure push is always going to face such steep resistance, because the implications are so consequential and stretch in so many different directions. And to be clear, by this I do not mean to excuse the actions of the gatekeepers which clearly include illegal criminal behavior and even on more than one occasion the murder of innocents, but just to point out that even when you look past those actions, this is a very consequential matter because much of our society runs on this underlying understanding of what reality is about, what our origins can be traced to, etc. And what this does is blow all of that wide open, including the true and complicated origins of various religious traditions still being followed by billions of people across the planet, even today. One thing that will become clear today, I think, is the power of what some call groupthink, the power of tradition that makes it difficult for people to sometimes see what's lying in plain sight. That's true both of traditional biblical scholarship and religious studies, and also modern archaeology. Both of these fields of inquiry have very set-in-stone notions about what they are actually studying, what the nature of the enterprise is about, and what the explanatory options are. Neither of these fields really looks closely at the UFO phenomenon, for instance, and yet I would argue that both of these inevitably end up pointing squarely in that direction. To aid us in our exploration today, we're going to be referring to a book by Paul Wallace titled Escaping from Eden: Does Genesis Teach That the Human Race Was Created by God or Engineered by ETs? Again, the book Escaping from Eden by Paul Wallace. Now let's jump in exactly where he does in Genesis 1:1. Of course, Genesis means beginning or the coming into being of something. In Genesis 1:1, we read in English, "In the beginning, God created." Now he points out, quote, "When I read this verse in English, there's no problem. With my interlinear Bible open, the Hebrew text on one side and the Greek of the Septuagint on the other, I can't escape a rather big question. Why is this word, Elohim, which is translated as God, shaped like a plural noun? How come it's a plural if there's only one God?" Unquote. Now, I just want to give a bit of context here. When people read the Bible in English, if they have an interlinear Bible, that means they can see the original terms in the sideline, in the margins. And what he notices here is that while in English we read the word God, the term actually being used there in the Hebrew is Elohim, and that's a plural term. Everything here seems to suggest plural, and yet it is translated in English as a singular term, and a term specifically referring to God, the one monotheistic God. What he's going to make an argument for here, and strongly so, is that this is deceiving, this is misguiding, this does not point to what the text is really suggesting in the original language, which in this case is Hebrew. From there, he jumps into the next anomaly, which is found in Genesis 1:26, where we read, "Let us make," and that's what the NIV says, which is a translation in English. "Wait a minute," he says, "who is this us? This is the dawn of time before any intelligent creature has been named. So who or what are the others that God is talking to?" Unquote. And then he continues, quote, Genesis 1:26, "Let us make humans to look like us, in the image and likeness of ourselves." The footnotes in my New Jerusalem Bible say, quote, "Image is a concrete term implying a physical appearance like that between Adam and his son." So these Elohim are plural, creative, and physical. What's that about? Unquote. And of course, this is an excellent point. How have we looked at these texts for generations and generations and generations and not seen what's staring us squarely in the face? That we have terms when read in the original languages that speak to plural gods, not a singular god, and even the text when translated into English sometimes render as "let us make," and then this notion of making humans in the image of, a physical image of, a being that already exists, which again, as he points out, this is suggesting that these beings are plural, creative, and physical. This goes against the notions we are taught in these religious circles, and yet this is what the texts themselves are telling us. And let us for a minute consider the implications here. When you think about the fact that one of the anomalies we are trying to make sense of is why these beings that are encountered look so humanoid, sometimes even so much like a human, well, in these original texts, this kind of turns the entire thing on its head, because what we find is we have been made, humankind has been made, in the image of a being, a kind of being, a physical being that already exists. That is to say, our blueprint, if you will, is found in a physical being that already exists. And again, as we're going to build the case today, perhaps this very being is the kind of beings we are still encountering even today, that they've never really gone away, that rather, because we have misinterpreted, misunderstood who various beings have been across the scope of human history, we have failed to see this point. And once that revelation comes clear, it really changes the context of what's happening right now, where we are seeing an increasing ramp up of activity from these beings, and also a supposed move towards some sort of acknowledgement of their presence. One point I've made note of, both on various podcast episodes, as well as in the courses I teach, is this notion of synchronistic orchestration. The sense that when you look back at your life and your involvement with this phenomenon in various ways, which has been very personal for me, how that tends to recontextualize your entire history. Now, one thing that occurs to me that's very interesting is part of my history involves getting a biblical studies degree within a religious studies department. And while I wasn't at the time considering the UFO phenomenon, when I now apply that lens, that filter, if you will, to this material, it makes so much sense, so much more sense than it ever made before in terms of the options I was provided in that academic circle to try to make sense of these texts. And that background will also help me guide us a little bit through today's episode. One thing I want to point out is that what we read in English of, for instance, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, aspects of the Hebrew Bible, that has actually been edited together, compiled from different sources. While conservative religious believers wouldn't look at it that way, academics do. They see telltale signs that different texts from different traditions have been amalgamated and edited to fit together more nicely. And this speaks to something known as the J interpreter, which was one of these sources that supposedly played an editing role in taking different texts and not only joining them together, but sometimes making edits to make them seem more consistent and coherent than they really are when seen in their original form. I want to read something about what the J source refers to. Quote, "In biblical scholarship, the term J refers to the Yahwist source, one of the four main sources believed by many scholars to have contributed to the composition of the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. These four sources are known as the documentary hypothesis, which posits that the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, was not written by a single author, but rather compiled from multiple sources over a long period of time. The Yahwist source, designated as J because it often refers to God as Yahweh, Yod Heh Vav Heh in Hebrew, is thought to have been composed around the 10th century BCE. It contains narratives characterized by vivid storytelling, anthropomorphic portrayals of God, and a focus on the southern kingdom of Judah." Unquote. So that gives you a sense of what's going on here. This is not just stitching together different texts, but editing them at different points to make them seem more continuous with each other, that they are speaking about the same kinds of beings, for instance. What we're going to find out today, which is extremely consequential, is that in the original text, in the original language, we have different terms referring to different beings, and later, editors then conflated these terms, reduced them to one term, God, to give this sense of one monotheistic creator interacting with humankind over time. But that is not what the original text suggests, not in the original language prior to this editing at a much later time in human history. Now, speaking of this notion of a recontextualization of these stories, of these narratives, when you take into consideration the original text, as well as what we know of geological history, Earth history, for instance, what we sometimes find is that this turns what we might have thought of as a beginning into a regeneration, regenesis, if you will, recovering after some massive cataclysm. Now, Paul Wallace gets into that in this next section. Quote, "Picture a world shrouded in darkness and engulfed in water. Its surface is peppered by a few scarcely habitable islands, sparsely populated by a handful of species from before the cataclysm. This world of darkness and water is the canvas for creation, as we find it depicted by Genesis, by the Mesopotamian tablets, and also in a Mesoamerican document called Popol Vuh. Popol Vuh, the People's Book, is a creation account from out of the ancient Mayan culture of Central America. Let me describe this almost blank canvas. The darkness is an atmospheric canopy of ash and soot. The waters are the sea levels raised by unimaginable volumes of water released by the melting of an ice shelf 2 miles thick, which had previously covered the northern half of the planet. A growing consensus among experts today is that this was the appearance of much of planet Earth following the impact of the Clovis comet on the Laurentide ice sheet above the Great Lakes, just as Earth was emerging from an ice age. A black sedimentary layer all over North America, South America, Western Europe, and the western part of Asia bears dramatic witness to an ensuing conflagration encompassing hundreds of thousands of square miles, followed by catastrophic flooding. The canopy of dust and soot that resulted from the wildfires then blocked out the sunlight over the northern half of the planet. Coupled with a cessation of the warming Atlantic current due to the invasion of meltwater into the ocean, the combined forces plunged the world almost overnight into an ice age even more severe than before, one known as the Younger Dryas Cold Period. It was a dramatic and super rapid transition of climate, marked by the kind of flash freezing that famously could freeze a mammoth mid-mouthful. As the ice sheet melted, it is estimated that sea levels would have risen between 40 and 60 meters, submerging any coastal habitations. In recent years, a number of researchers have uncovered evidence of the Clovis Comet, ELE, and a new consensus is building. In 2007, Richard Firestone, a staff scientist at the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, put the theory of the Clovis Comet impact squarely on the map when he found micro-sized balls of metals, spherules, and nano-sized diamonds in a layer of sediment dating 12,900 years ago at a dozen different archaeological sites in New Mexico. Firestone put these forward as evidence of a massive comet exploding mid-air and impacting various sites, extinguishing the prehistoric Clovis civilization of North America and sending into extinction 75-80% of the continent's megafauna. It is estimated that 36 species, including mammoths, mastodon, woolly rhinoceros, and saber-toothed tiger, went extinct through this event. Unquote. Now, of course, what makes consideration of these ancient cataclysms so consequential for today is that there is mounting evidence that these are cyclical in nature and that we may be overdue for one of these again. When we also take into consideration that some of these beings may have been responsible for some of these cataclysms or somehow involved, and we think about how they are more present now than they have been recently, as we approach a time where something cyclically might happen again involving a cataclysm, this raises very interesting questions, questions that many don't want to ask. Now, speaking of this notion of floods being triggered by geological events, one notion that has come up, a theory that has come up, is called crustal displacement. And this is also known as earth crust displacement, and it is a geological hypothesis that suggests the outer shell of the earth, the lithosphere, can move independently from the underlying mantle. This movement could potentially lead to significant changes in the Earth's surface, including shifts in continents and alterations in global climate patterns. Regarding historic Earth floods, proponents of the crustal displacement theory suggest that sudden shifts in the Earth's crust could have triggered cataclysmic events such as massive floods. They propose that these shifts may have caused a sudden release of large volumes of water from glacial ice sheets, leading to widespread flooding across large areas. Now, the key here is when we read biblical accounts about floods and floods that are recorded in various religious traditions around the world, we see this commonality. And could it be speaking to the very events we're touching on here, these previous cataclysms? Now, of course, one of the people that has been a chief proponent of this notion is Graham Hancock. He's a controversial figure in the field of alternative history and archaeology, and he has proposed theories regarding the Younger Dryas period, which we just mentioned, and its implication for Earth's history and future. Key points are that he suggests that the Younger Dryas period, which occurred roughly 12,900 to 11,700 years ago, was marked by a sudden and catastrophic event or series of events that drastically altered the Earth's climate. He proposes that this event may have been caused by a comet impact or multiple impacts, leading to widespread environmental devastation and contributing to the extinction of various megafauna species such as mammoths and saber-toothed cats. He also then discusses this notion of a civilization reset, theorizing that cataclysmic events of the Younger Dryas period led to the destruction or decline of advanced civilizations that existed on the Earth at the time. He also suggests that these civilizations may have possessed knowledge and technology that greatly surpassed what is conventionally believed for that era. According to Hancock, evidence of these lost civilizations can be found in ancient megalithic structures and myths from around the world. Hancock proposes that the Younger Dryas cataclysm was not an isolated event, but rather part of a recurring cycle of global catastrophes that have shaped the course of human history, suggesting that humanity has undergone multiple cycles of rise and fall, with advanced civilizations periodically emerging and then being destroyed or declining due to cataclysmic events. Now, building on this interpretation of Earth's history, Hancock warns about the potential for future catastrophic events that could threaten human civilization, advocating for increased awareness and preparation for such risks, including the possibility of comet impacts or other natural disasters. Now, the point here is that when we look at the intervals of these cycles, we are overdue for just such an event. Now, again, when we look beyond natural causes, could it be that some of these other beings also have a role to play? When we look at the texts from these ancient religious traditions, that certainly seems to be suggested. But again, that might be an interpretation. We also have points in history where we have in the lore recorded times where these beings actually rescued people from cataclysms, even if they were minor cataclysms. For instance, you may recall from one of the episodes we did covering Artie Sixkiller-Clark's work, where she documents the encounters of indigenous cultures around the world. She recounted an event from South America where an entire tribe, an entire village was saved when a volcano was about to erupt, that the night before a giant UFO appeared, people in a trance-like state from the entire village got on the UFO and were taken away to safety just prior to the eruption of the volcano, which would have wiped out everyone and did indeed wipe out the village, so that our modern record shows that there is nothing but rubble left in its wake. All right, now we're going to rejoin Paul Wallace as he continues his survey of what we find in Genesis. Now, in Genesis 2:17, we find, "But you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die." Again, that's the translation from the NIV. For a moment, those of you, including myself, who have a background as Christians, I'd ask you to put aside for a moment what you've been taught about these verses and consider them from a different point of view. Wallace says the following, quote, "How is the knowledge of good and evil a bad thing for humans to have? If God wanted humans to be capable of free choice and love, then surely this kind of moral awareness is absolutely essential. If the humans are incapable of distinguishing good from bad, then how can they choose the good, or be held culpable if they choose the bad?" Unquote. He jumps then into Genesis 3:22, where we find, "And Yahweh Elohim said, See, the human has become like one of us," according to the NIV translation. Now again, he says, quote, "Just a second, one of who? Who is God like that we humans would be like them?" This isn't a literary tick. It's not a royal we or an author's we. This really is a plural form. Then we jump into Genesis 4:14. Quote, I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. That's from the NIV again. And Paul says, quote, excuse me, who are these other people? These whoever's outside the garden who are going to kill Cain if they meet him. They can't be children of Adam and Eve, so who? Unquote. So again, he's pointing here to the fact that even the text itself is inconsistent. If these were the first humans, period, then who are these others? And by the way, in that earlier passage we read from Genesis 3:22, we notice that this editor, after the fact, has done something very interesting. They put together two words, Yahweh and Elohim. Those are different terms for God. Yahweh is a name for a God, a being. Elohim, again, is a plural term referring to something more like powerful ones. So to try to conflate these in people's minds, he puts these terms right next together. But it doesn't really make any sense when you really think about the origin of those words in their original context. All right, so now I want to jump back into something Wallace says here. Quote, just a reminder that Genesis has taken from a number of sources and interwoven them to create the familiar version. So some texts tell stories of the Elohim. Others speak of Yahweh, the holy name of God, revealed to Moses at a later stage. Scholars call this second narrator J, or more traditionally, Moses, unquote. So again, there he's talking about this later editing that was done and the stitching together of different texts to make them seem more continuous than they actually are. Now, reflecting on this, he says the following, quote, I remember reading up at college on 18th century Bible scholars like Jean Astruc, Karl Heinrich Graf, and Julius Wellhausen, who talked about the redactors, scissors and paste editors, who put Genesis into its current shape. These academics might not have entirely nailed it, but it's easy to see how J inserts the holy name into Genesis. Sometimes J replaces Elohim with Yahweh. Example, Genesis 11, 6-7 and 18:21-19:1. Other times he just adds the name Yahweh to Elohim in an Elohim story. Example, Genesis 3:22. We just looked at that a moment ago. Continuing, quote, I can see why he would do that. J is telling the reader to see the hand of Yahweh in the drama of the stories. How did I miss the implication of this? Because the very presence of the post-Moses name of Yahweh in Genesis tells me that we are not reading the original version of Genesis. J isn't hiding what he is doing. When he adds the holy name, J shows to the reader that he is taking an even older story, which was probably a known story, a written or oral tradition, and in plain sight, he alters it. So now I have to ask, what about the original version of these stories? What text was J working with? And if they weren't Yahweh stories, and if the Elohim in them were plural, were the original versions of the Genesis stories God stories at all? Unquote. Very consequential. And I think people with a religious background will be surprised when they read this, because again, his point is, this is kind of staring us in the face, especially when you have the advantage, as I've had, as he has had, of reading this in the original languages. Then it becomes very, very clear. Now, regarding the fact that he points out there that Jay was likely taking older stories and then moving them into this newer story or joining them in a way and then replacing terms here and there to make them seem like one continuous story revolving around the same main character, this, of course, begs the question, where were these original traditions coming from, these original renditions of these stories? Now, as we discussed on previous podcast episodes, you may remember that most of the evidence points clearly in the direction of the older Babylonian and Sumerian traditions, that these creation stories, if you will, even these flood stories, were taken from these older traditions and then co-opted into later renditions. Let's now jump back into this book, Escaping from Eden, as Wallace does his further survey of Genesis. Quote, I'm finding these plural forms further on in Genesis. If Elohim is supposed to be a general name for a god or a proper name for the one true God, Yahweh, then why does the word get given plural adjectives and verb forms? In this text, Abraham uses a plural Elohim with a plural verb. Genesis 11:7, Yahweh says, "Come, let us go down and let us confuse," plural verb, "their language there." That's one example. Jumping back into the book, he then takes on Genesis 22, saying, quote, "Abraham's near sacrifice of his son Isaac has never made sense to me. Why would a loving God, the God who had promised Abraham a family line through his son Isaac, then ask him to mimic the absolute worst of pagan religion and sacrifice his firstborn son? A plural, non-divine Elohim would make a lot more sense than Jay's edit of this episode. In this passage, Elohim and Yahweh actually play on opposite teams. It begins when Elohim tells Abraham to sacrifice his firstborn and only son. Quote, "It happened sometime later that Elohim put Abraham to the test. Elohim said, 'Take your son, your only son, offer him as a burnt offering.' Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to kill his son," unquote. Then Wallace continues, "Isn't this how other gods prove they had exacted total unquestioning obedience from their human subjects? The Greek islands, Phoenicia, the Near East, Mesoamerica, were all areas where child sacrifice was expected by the local Elohim. What must these Elohim have been to have produced such inhuman behavior among their subjects? When Elohim demands it of Abraham, the stakes are high. Isaac is a son from whom the people of Israel are supposed to descend. Hence Yahweh acts to prevent the killing. From out of heaven, the messenger of Yahweh shouted and called to Abraham, saying, 'Abraham, Abraham, do not raise your hand against the boy.'" If it was already well known, this story would pose a problem for Jay. There are too many gods in it. To turn it into a monotheistic text, Jay has translated Elohim to mean the same as Yahweh. He equates them by inserting the last word of the story's last sentence. Yahweh says, "Now I know that you fear Elohim and did not withhold your son from me." With this neat addendum, Jay turns it into a monotheistic text. But by equating Yahweh with the Elohim who gave the filicidal order, Jay changes the story from one of gracious divine rescue to a cruel divine test. And it makes the story a moral nonsense. How am I supposed to feel about a deity who commands unquestioning obedience, even to the point of being willing to kill your own children? Jay has turned it into a story with only one God in it, quote-unquote, but in so doing, the God, quote-unquote, he portrays becomes a monster. And from there, he jumps into this notion of a heavenly council. Who exactly are they? Jumping back into the book, quote, "Though it appeared to leave significant questions hanging, the Targum of Palestine pointed me to a phenomenon in the Bible that somehow I had never really noticed before." Again, as an aside, that points to how tradition and groupthink sometimes, often even perhaps, prevents us from seeing what's staring us in the face. Back into the book, quote, "I must have read about it and just dismissed it as a creative flourish rather than anything real. I am talking about the Heavenly Council. Once you look, the Heavenly Council evidences itself in many pages of Scripture. For instance, quote, El takes his stand in the divine assembly, surrounded by the Elohim, he gives judgment, Psalm 82:1, unquote. Now, many of you may remember from an earlier episode where we dove into Tom DeLonge and Peter Lavenda's Gods and Man, we discussed different kinds of beings recorded in Scripture, one of these groups being the B'nai Elohim and another being the Nephilim. Let's first take on the B'nai Elohim according to how Wallace considers this. Quote, "Whatever the B'nai Elohim are exactly, they're not God and they're not human. What they are has not been explained. For some strange reason, Jay assumes we all know about them. But from where? What other sources does Jay think we've been reading? Genesis 20:13 says, 'The Elohim caused me to wander from my father's house.' If Elohim is supposed to be a general name for a god or a proper name for the one true God, Yahweh, then why does the word get given plural attributives and verb forms? In this text, Abraham uses a plural Elohim with a plural verb. I have read commentators who say that Abraham wants to sound like a polytheist because he is talking to a polytheist. Really? And the editor didn't iron that out?" Unquote. Now, this is a great point. Again, we have the Elohim, which is plural, right? And this is different than Yahweh, which is a true name, and it's singular. But what he's also pointing to here is the B'nai Elohim, which is translated often as the sons of God, but that's because of how Elohim is treated often in Christian tradition. But if Elohim actually refers to something plural, meaning something like powerful ones, then B'nai Elohim would be the sons of the powerful ones. Now, getting back into the book, he now jumps into Psalm 89:6-8. Quote, "Who in the skies can compare with Yahweh? Who among the B'nai Elohim can rival him? God, awesome in the great assembly of B'nai Elohim, dreaded among all who surround him. Yahweh, God of armies, who is like you?" Unquote. Again, the question here is, what are these two groups? Because they certainly seem to be described as being against each other, in competition here. Because we hear about the B'nai Elohim, of them, who can rival him, meaning Yahweh. So again, here we seem to see in plain face, right in front of us, the description of these as being two different kinds of entities, one plural form, one singular. Jumping now into 1 Kings 22:19-23. Quote, "I saw Yahweh seated on his throne with the whole array of heaven standing behind him, on his right and on his left. Yahweh said, who will entice Ahab into marching to his death at Ramoth in Gilead? At which some answered one way and some answered another. A spirit then came forward and stood before Yahweh and said, I will entice him. I will go and be a deceiving spirit in the mouths of Ahab's prophets." Unquote. Again, we have different kinds of beings here in reference to some sort of a council where some say one thing, some say another. Again, take this out of this context and consider notions of a galactic federation and notions like that associated with the UFO phenomenon. We clearly are dealing with multiple beings, sometimes beings of seemingly different origin sources that have different agendas. Jumping back into the book, we read Wallace saying, quote, "One day when the B'nai Elohim came to attend on Yahweh, among them came the accuser," Job 1:6. The word accuser in the Job passage is often translated as Satan. However, the word appears here not as a name, but as a descriptor noun with a definite article, the accuser. Nevertheless, the presence of an accuser among the Elohim, apparently as a member of the heavenly council, is something that must raise an eyebrow or two. I was going to have to return to that later. Unquote. This is a key point. And I remember when I was studying this in academia, I noticed this evolution of the notion of Satan, that in the Hebrew Bible, it's much more of a member of a council, one of many. Only across time do we see this shift towards this binary view where we have God versus Satan as if they are these two arch forces in reality. That's not really what it was initially, and we see this change over time, which again speaks to editing and trying to fit these things into certain theological notions, but at a later time. But again, Wallace points out, quote, "If we read it that way, then without modifying the text one jot or tittle, we could say that in Genesis 1, Elohim doesn't have a heavenly council. Elohim is the heavenly council," unquote. Again, very consequential when you read it that way. All right, we've discussed Elohim, the powerful ones. We've discussed Yahweh, a different entity altogether. And we've discussed the B'nai Elohim, the sons of the powerful ones. Now enter this notion of hybrids actually recorded in the Bible. These are the Nephilim. We are going to jump into Genesis 6:1-4, where Wallace says, quote, "When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God, the B'nai Elohim, saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. Unquote. Let's stop there for a second. We think about augmentations and genetic alterations over time of humankind that is part of the lore within the UFO phenomenon. Think about that in terms of lifespans being extended and reduced amongst humankind, as recorded in these passages in various scriptural traditions. Jumping back into Wallace's commentary here, quote, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The term Nephilim is often interpreted as meaning fallen ones or giants, and they are described as being mighty and renowned figures. The passage suggests that they were the offspring of unions between sons of God, which again means the B'nai Elohim, the sons of the powerful ones, and human women. He continues, quote, "The identity of the sons of God is a matter of debate among scholars. Some interpretations suggest that they were divine beings, possibly angels or other celestial entities, who took human form. According to this view, the Nephilim would be considered hybrids, resulting from the union between these divine beings and human women." Unquote. Let's just pause there for a moment and let that sink in. With my work with the John Mack Institute, so much of the abduction phenomenon in the 90s and before revolved around the hybridization project, which produced, of course, hybrids. What if we were talking about the same different kinds of beings conducting the same kinds of affairs over the course of the entire scope of human history, from the very beginning right up until now, and perhaps leading to some final point, some inflection point that we are quickly approaching? Let's jump back into this notion of hybrids recorded across traditions. Wallace says, quote, "As the human population continues to expand, the people encounter other powerful ones, / Elohim, who begin abducting human females and having children with them. Their progeny are the giants of legend. This strange scenario of godlike beings taking human wives would seem a bizarre plot twist even for a 21st century movie, let alone an account purporting to explain how we got here. Yet it is a story retold in the mythologies of countless cultures around the world. Each has found a mode of preserving the same narrative from prehistory until today. It repeats in Hindu mythology and in Greco-Roman mythology. It's part of the sagas of Norse and Celtic lore. The ancient mythologies of Mesopotamia recount it in great detail. And in all the mythologies of the powerful ones, intercourse with humans produces demigods and titans, quote, men and women of legend, unquote. Continuing, quote, "Some of these hybrid people have become familiar to us through the literature of Greek mythology. In all, there are 28 hybrid people named in the Greek panoply. Hindu lore names 17. There are a couple in Norse mythology and one in Celtic mythology. As human society grows and becomes harder to manage, the council decides that the human beings are living too long and takes a decision to limit the humans' lifespans. Troubling news of abductions of human females and resultant hybridization also reaches the ears of the council. This is not what they had intended. After a period of intense debate, a final solution is agreed. Earth will be wiped clean of the human menace by means of a massive flood. But not all the powerful ones are agreed. So it is that a message is brought to a man called Noah. Along with a warning about the impending flood, Noah is given instructions to construct a rescue vessel and seal his family inside, together with a stock of plants and animals to reseed flora and fauna and reboot the human population with the DNA of his extended family. Then comes the deluge. Indigenous mythologies from around the world tell the tale of a great flood and the repopulation of Earth. It's in the folklore of China, Peru, Korea, Malaysia, Ireland, southern Iraq, northern Iraq / southeastern Turkey, Hawaii, Finland, Polynesia, and the Philippines. It's in the oral tradition of First Nation Americans and in the Australian Aboriginal creation story." And then jumping ahead a little bit, quote, "In the aftermath of the flood, the powerful one speaketh the regrettable violence of the deluge and vow never to do such a thing again. They affirm a standard of accountability for murder and genocide. Even the animals must now account for any human lives they take. On instruction from the powerful ones, the humans now add fish and meat to their diet. Humanity will now rebuild itself with a gene pool of five families, the extended family of Noah. As human society re-expands, the people migrate east of Eden. When the people reach the Shinar Plain, Mesopotamia, the home of Sumeria and Babylonia, they settle and build something incredible. This geographic detail is noteworthy because Mesopotamia is generally acknowledged as the cradle of modern civilization. Equipped with a whole package of agricultural systems, cityscapes with streets, plumbing, and the beginnings of metal technology. And now we're going to jump ahead a little bit in the narrative again. Quote, "Then rapidly this package began springing up all around the planet, as if the concentration of expertise in Mesopotamia had been blown by the four winds to self-replicate all around the world. What the people now construct in Babylon is a tower, a gateway between the people and the powerful ones, a means of reaching the heavens from earth." And as a quick aside to point out something that might seem obvious, heavens here can mean the stars, outer space, etc. Continuing with the text, quote, "If El is short for Elohim, then Babel means a gateway to or for the powerful ones. However, when members of the council make a visit to observe the project, they are deeply disturbed, fearing that the humans have become too capable. Another brutal response is called for. The powerful ones use their great powers to destroy the city-state and arrest the development of human civilization. They do this by taking from the humans the language which has united them, confusing their ability to speak so that the humans are no longer able to communicate with one another and operate as a single society." Nothing happens after that until in Genesis 12:1, we encounter the great patriarch Abraham in a world that looks pretty much like ours. He has to negotiate a world of nomadic cities, city-states, and the beginnings of empires. It is a world of trade, wars, and peace treaties. The religious and cultural environment is one of diversity and negotiation. It is, more or less, the world as we know it. But the journey by which we have arrived has been a bizarre one. If you're at all acquainted with the mythologies that flowed from ancient Mesopotamia, you will quickly recognize that my retelling of Genesis is far from a piece of random fiction. It is a story already known to exist. It resides in the oldest depository of writing known to humanity, etched indelibly in cuneiform script on the dark stone tablets of the ancient Sumerians, Babylonians, Akkadians, and Assyrians. At one level, this literary overlap shouldn't really come as any great surprise. Abraham and Sarah, the progenitors of the Judeo-Christian tradition, grew up in Samaria. They left as adults from Ur of the Chaldees. Abraham and Sarah's whole education was a Sumerian one. So within the Bible, that was ultimately to issue from their family's faith, we should fully expect to find the remnants of their culture of origin. Yet once highlighted, these literary overlaps do far more than simply add a gloss or two to our familiar story of beginnings. They change the whole picture. That's because in its current form, the creation account of Genesis stands as a kind of antithesis to the Sumerian narratives and their Babylonian, Akkadian, and Assyrian spin-offs. The book of Genesis seems to say, never mind those old stories, here's what really happened. But the moment we retranslate Elohim as a plural or as a collective noun, Genesis does an incredible volte-face. Instead of critiquing the Sumerian account, plural Genesis actually confirms it, story after story. This was quite a shift for me. Somehow I had always pictured the Bible as if it were the truth against the world. It turns out the truth is even stranger. It was the same funny feeling that disturbed many good religious people back in the 19th century, as these forgotten stories resurfaced, all predating the familiar canon of biblical accounts. In the cuneiform glyphs transliterating Sumerian, Babylonian, and Assyrian accounts, some familiar motifs repeat. Unquote. Now, where Wallace is going with this is that this, of course, changes our understanding of our religious histories and the commonalities amongst these different traditions from different cultures from around the world who didn't have any direct contact with each other, speaks to some ancient memory, some collective memory in deep human history, attesting to this beginning that involves different kinds of beings, and not just beginnings, but regenerations after events that happened, cataclysms that happened in deep human history. And now in one final turn towards this book, Escaping from Eden, we want to consider Wallace's commentary regarding a so-called war in heaven. He says, quote, Once you have seen the similarities, it is impossible to just walk away from them. Either Genesis has retold the cuneiform stories, or Genesis and the cuneiform tablets are together recalling ancient narratives known to both cultures. Given that Abraham and Sarah were already mature people when they left Sumeria, it would seem most logical that it is the narrative of Genesis that has recast the Sumerian account, which had also seeded the Assyrian and Babylonian versions. The New Testament book of Revelation neatly summarizes the extra cuneiform storylines in six Greek words, quote, "and there was war in heaven," unquote. The war is around struggles for preeminence and the progress of the human race, unquote. So what we have here when we reflect on today's material is a retelling of religious history. When you think about the original languages and what these terms suggest, when you think about notions like heavens refers to outer space in more ancient cultures, then suddenly you realize that these beings were perhaps not gods as we often think of them, but powerful beings that were also physical, that also had a role in creating and shaping human life. And that furthermore, there are different kinds of beings that sometimes have different agendas. And when we consider all of that in the times we are in now, when we have this ramp up of interaction from these beings, where we see this progress towards some sort of official disclosure acknowledging their existence, do we therefore from there go towards an acknowledgement of their role in our history? That remains to be seen. As I've said many times, what is perplexing about this is that you can't really take the lid off Pandora's box without all of this spilling out. And how will humankind respond as a result? On the one hand, it's incredibly destabilizing. On the other, it perhaps creates a reset possibility where we could change our civilization, where even the way we rally around government would be different. We could take this recasting of our history as an inflection point where we move in a new direction. Also, as I've been saying for quite some time now, we see amongst these various others a spectrum of consciousness just like we do amongst humankind, that to describe these others as either all good or all bad, fully benevolent or fully malevolent, doesn't do justice to the picture. And that should not be surprising to us. All conscious entities go through this progression back towards source consciousness. That's true for us and it's true for them. And we should remember because of that, that even while there are groups that would like to take advantage of humankind, and there are human elites who have made accords with those various groups, and this is indeed what David Grush is likely referring to in his testimony before Congress, we should not forget that overarchingly there is some sense of a council that in previous eras was referred to as a heavenly council or a divine council that we would more recently perhaps refer to under the guise of the UFO phenomenon as the Galactic Federation, an overarching superstructure that ultimately has the final say in what happens here. Now, ultimately, we don't know what's going to happen with human civilization. As I've been saying for a while now, we are seeing a confluence of forces suggesting that this world would not be anything like it is now in 10 years. That's not just because of the presence of these others, but also because there are so many things happening within human civilization that are so consequential, things that will come to a head sooner than later. And as I've been saying, I don't think that's coincidental to the simultaneous arise of our awareness of these others in our midst. Rather than shrinking in fear in the face of these most consequential times, I would suggest we embrace this as a truly transformational moment in human history, one that beckons us forward to take up new roles as denizens of a truly cosmic and fundamentally interconnected order, where our beginnings matter far less than our true nature as fractals of source consciousness itself. And to that point, I will leave you with a quote from poet and scholar Rumi, who famously said, "You are not a drop in the ocean, you are the ocean in a drop." And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.